I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
For the first time in almost 3 years, Israeli tanks turned their turrets today and began their withdrawal from parts of Gaza. And Israeli and Palestinian commanders shook hands as bulldozers removed road barriers and Gazans returned to jobs, as the roadmap to peace began a ceasefire phase. But also today, several shooting incidents in the West Bank. In one, a foreign worker on an Israeli construction team was shot dead by a Palestinian splinter group that has not yet signed on to the truce. Alon Ben David is the national security correspondent for Israel's Channel 10 TV. He joins us from Tel Aviv. Hello, Alon.
Hello, Robin.
Well, the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Group, a splinter group of Fatah, the military wing of the PLO, has claimed today's shooting. You had advance warning?
No, not really, but they've been saying since yesterday that they won't join the ceasefire agreement that was reached within the Palestinian factions. In fact, there are quite a few factions in the West Bank that are not accepting this agreement. In fact, one of my colleagues here in Channel 10 was right in front of the commander of Al-Aqsa Brigades in Jenin when he announced proudly that his men have conducted the shooting attack outside Jenin that killed this Bulgarian worker. So there are many worrying signs about this ceasefire, but still there are some also encouraging signs. We've seen in the past 24 hours a serious drop in the number of concrete warnings about terror attacks that Israeli security services are receiving. From 60 yesterday, we have 50 today. That means that still right now there are 50 different terror cells that are planning attacks in Israel, but still there is a drop here. Mm-hmm. It's not complete. It's nothing final yet, but maybe it's first sign for a change.
And in many areas we're reading that Israeli troops have been replaced by Palestinian policemen. What's the sense that on the Israeli side? Will the Israelis tolerate, if you will, the low-level attacks like today's to keep the peace plan in process?
I think at least for a while. I just returned from the Gaza Strip, and I've seen that what might be considered as utopian pictures. I mean, Israeli troops and Palestinian police working together. We haven't seen it for quite a while. So maybe they will give it a chance, but still there's such a huge chasm of distrust and suspicion between the side. And I could say I think that each side is expecting the other side to fail the process. I mean, Israelis are expecting an attack any minute, and the Palestinians are thinking that the Israelis won't hold and try to attack them. So everybody is expecting the other side to fail this process, but still I think that hope is such a rare commodity in this region. So everybody's willing to give it a chance.
Well, does each side want the other side to fail first? In other words, how much will the Palestinian leaders try to clamp down on groups like Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade?
Well, currently they're trying to do that in way of agreements and not by force. They're not trying to enforce this agreement on Hamas and on the Fatah groups. They're trying to reach agreement, to reach understandings. I'm not sure this could work. I mean, at some point, if these attacks continues, either the Israelis will have to respond or you'll see the Palestinian Authority trying again to enforce this agreement on those factions, what they didn't try to do until now.
Mm. And just in the few seconds we have, Alon, we see pictures of Israeli soldiers hugging each other in joy. They're going home. Palestinian boys trotting behind tanks, waving flags of their country that might one day exist. If the peace process survives. In your heart, how are you feeling?
Well, everything is very reversible at the moment, and it is designed to be like that. I mean, Israel has planned this process to be reversible, so in case things will go wrong, it can change in a minute. It will take only a day to bring these tanks into Gaza again. But certainly everybody is happy to see a first sign of hope. As I said before, it's so rare here, and people, I think, are very exhausted of this ongoing conflict that they are willing to go for any small chance.
Well, Alon, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Alon Ben David, National Security Correspondent for Israel's Channel 10 TV.
Lawmakers in New Jersey and California have until midnight tonight to balance the books and figure out how and where to spend and cut. If there is no agreement by that midnight deadline, New Jersey lawmakers have warned state workers they may have to shut down everything but essential government services. And in California, there is a $38 billion deficit to contend with, the largest shortfall in its history. Of course, New Jersey and California aren't the only ones in the red. Most states are facing major budgetary problems, and fierce battles are being fought in state capitals across the country. Joining me on the line from Washington, D.C. is Jason White, a reporter for Stateline.org. And Jason, your beat is reporting on state budgets, so describe for us what's at stake here, particularly in New Jersey and California.
Well, in those two states, if they do not pass budgets by midnight tonight, the future is a bit uncertain. What typically happens in these situations is what they call a government shutdown, where the majority of state programs just sort of go on hold for a while. In California, they have a plan to have a continuing resolution to fund government with a significant loan, which they will then pay back as soon as they pass a budget. But if they do not pass a budget tonight, operations will be scaled back to some degree.
Now, what are the solutions that most of these states seem to be reaching for? Does it seem to be more cutting or more finding new sources of revenue?
It is definitely more cutting. About two-thirds of these gaps have been closed through cutting, and then maybe another third through tax and fee increases. But that doesn't mean the tax and fee increases have been small. Governors in 29 states proposed about $17.5 billion worth of revenue increases, and this would be the largest total tax increase since 1979.
Are any states doing this particularly well?
The states are in quite varying positions. A state like California, where their deficit is nearly a third of what they say they would need to spend next year in order to just keep services where they are, is in a very different position from a state like Wyoming, which has actually been doing quite well and hasn't had many budget problems at all. And that's largely due to coal, which is a resource from which they derive quite a bit of tax revenue.
It is pretty astonishing when you look back just 3 years ago, California had a $9 billion surplus, and many other states were in the black, too. So what happened? I mean, were state lawmakers short-sighted in thinking that the good times were just going to go forever?
Conservatives have certainly been arguing that. This is quite typical for California, unfortunately. They tend to go through these boom and bust cycles. And quite a few other states have also been sort of caught up in this boom and bust, tracking quite closely with the stock market. And a few states, such as Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Jersey, New York, California, and Oregon out on the West Coast, depend quite heavily on tax revenues from the trading of stocks. And so their budgets just got nailed when the stock market went south.
And looking ahead, are lawmakers going to be facing the exact same situation next year?
Well, there are some signs that the economy is picking up, and I think state lawmakers are a little more hopeful than they have been probably at any point in the last 2 years. They are predicting some modest growth, not for this next fiscal year, but for the one after. So as far as the economy goes, that's where the states go. And so they're just out there hoping for some sort of turnaround in the national economic conditions.
Well, Jason, I know you'll be keeping an eye on it, and particularly as that midnight deadline approaches. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Gil.
Jason White is a reporter for Stateline.org.
The National Catholic Reporter is reporting that the Vatican will soon name Bishop Sean O'Malley as the new bishop of the Boston Archdiocese. O'Malley would replace Cardinal Bernard Law, who stepped down last December amid the church sex abuse scandal. If the report is true, this would be the third post-scandal assignment for Bishop O'Malley. He was brought to Palm Beach only a year ago, after two bishops there were implicated in sex abuse scandals. And he served as bishop of the Fall River Diocese in Massachusetts for a decade, following the case of Father James Porter. Well, Eric McLeish is an attorney currently representing alleged victims of clergy sexual abuse. And Eric, you know Bishop O'Malley from the Father Porter case in Fall River, right?
That's correct. I represented 101 people in 1992 and 1993 who settled claims with the Fall River Diocese, and I got to know Bishop O'Malley well during that process.
Well, this was an incredibly explosive case. Reverend Porter pleaded guilty to molesting 28 children. He went to prison, and then, as you say, there were other cases that were settled.
That's right.
What did Bishop O'Malley do to change the situation in Fall River?
Well, he did a number of things. As in this situation, he was brought in to try to find some way to resolve the problems. What I remember most about Bishop O'Malley is how humble he was and how compassionate he was with the victims. Unlike cardinal law, Bishop O'Malley during the Porter settlement dealt face-to-face with victims. In fact, there was one situation where there was some problem that developed during settlement discussions, and our clients at 8 o'clock at night went down to Fall River to see Bishop O'Malley at his residence, and he received them. And he was happy to talk to them. I remember another instance when Bishop O'Malley just showed up at one of the weekly meetings we would have for Porter victims, and he just sat there and listened. So this is a man who, long ago in this church, got it. And I think the significance of this potential appointment, if it's true, cannot be understated. And I think it will go a long way towards bringing about resolution of these cases and some measure of reconciliation.
Well, he also did some concrete things, as well as the things you're speaking of, in establishing a model for dealing with accusations against priests. He insisted on referring victims to social workers unaffiliated with the church, conducting background checks for all workers and volunteers in the church.
And he also removed a lot of priests. And it's significant that that was part of the settlement that we negotiated, that when we negotiated a resolution of what was then the largest financial settlement, the Porter victims didn't just want to take the money and run. They wanted to make sure it never happened again. And what was amazing about Bishop O'Malley is that he was receptive to victims talking about solutions of how the diocese ought to be operated in a way that was friendly to victims. Mm-hmm. And that was extraordinary at the time. Much of what he did then has been incorporated now into national programs with the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops.
Well, briefly, Bishop O'Malley is also known as a conservative on doctrinal questions, a Franciscan who often wears his brown Franciscan habit, and one of the few American bishops with a beard.
That's right, and sandals too, Robin.
Well, just real brief, how do you think he's going to be received in Boston?
I think he'll be well received. He's very humble. He's the right person at the right time for this job. He's not someone where there'll be a lot of glitz and a lot of glamour, but he's a humble person, compassionate person. He's the right person for this job at this time.
Well, Eric, we'll be waiting to see if the announcement is made this week, and if it is indeed, Bishop O'Malley, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Attorney Eric McLeish represents alleged victims of clergy sexual abuse in Boston. Katharine Hepburn's death reminds us of her life, on screen and as the Connecticut Yankee whose first role, according to the Boston Globe, was as a six-year-old, handing out balloons promoting voting rights for women. And the Globe had another passing of note. Diane Gepie Akins, who coached the Loyola College women's lacrosse team from her wheelchair after treatment for a brain tumor left her paralyzed. Gepie Akins was a star player who later led the Greyhounds to the NCAAs 10 times, coaching all but the last game of this year's tournament. Her players said it was the greatest gift to say, "She's my coach." Opposing teams wore green, Loyola's colors, in her honor. She called herself fortunate to be able to say goodbye to her players every day. So, two terrific women have left the stage. Diane Gepie Akins succumbed to brain cancer yesterday at the age of 40. Katharine Hepburn died at her Connecticut home at 96.
I'm tough by nature, tough, direct. If you do something that is unpopular, but you believe in it, I think that's what matters.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris. Bill Delaney is away.
It's Here and Now.
Despite the calf muscle he pulled, President Bush, whose enthusiasm for running extends beyond politics, wraps up a two-week fundraising sprint in Florida today. He's the headliner for a $2,000 per plate lunch in Miami and an equally pricey dinner in Tampa. And he's not alone. Vice President Dick Cheney is also fundraising in two states today, and Democrat Howard Dean has raised $9 million so far this year, more than $6 million of it in the past 3 months. Joining us on the line are members of our D.C. roundtable. David Shribman is executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Hello, David.
Hello.
And Andrea Stone is congressional correspondent for USA Today. Hello, Andrea.
Hi.
What about those numbers? Have we seen anything like this in terms of President Bush's fundraising? Is this unprecedented?
Well, I think it's unprecedented. It sure gives the lie to the threat of deflation, doesn't it? The president, as you know, raised more money than anyone ever did in the 2000 election when he was merely the governor of Texas. For the 2004 election when he's the president of the United States and a favorite to be reelected, it's going to be hard for people who are in his corner to say no when he comes asking, and he's asking and they're giving.
Because you have to wonder what he's going to use the money for, because he's not going to have a primary opponent, which is not something that the Democrats can say for sure. If you put all the money that the Democrats have raised so far, it's a pittance compared to Bush.
And were you surprised by the amount of money that Howard Dean has raised?
You know, it's interesting. He's really come on. I think in the beginning people weren't taking him as seriously as some of the other front runners, especially John Kerry and John Edwards, who led in the last quarter of fundraising. But he has really put a push on the Internet and really is coming into his own. The person who has got to be worried tonight as the midnight deadline comes along is Joe Lieberman, who came into this race, you know, as should have been the front runner as the 2000 vice presidential candidate, but yet has really had a lot of trouble getting traction on the fundraising front.
And fundraising is important because, as you know, we often refer to it as the first primary. It's one in which there are some rules, but not a lot of rules, and in which the winner can actually be quantified, and you can't quantify the winner in other kinds of pre-primary activities. So it's something that's very important, not only because it's important, but because we all say it's important.
Exactly. It's one of those benchmarks. I mean, how else are you going to measure it except by those quarterly financial reports? And as you say, that has to be filed by midnight tonight.
Right.
How do we think John Kerry's going to do in that lineup?
Well, I think he'll do fairly well, but I wanted to throw a little bit of a caveat on here. If money were everything, Ross Perot would be running for the election.
Right.
Good point. We do have to keep this in perspective, don't we? And what does it tell us that Dean was able to raise so much of his money over the Internet? Is that a more efficient way of doing it?
It might say something about who his supporters are. I mean, there's a younger generation out there that gets most of its news, or more of its news, rather, from the Internet and from online places. And MoveOn.org had an online, very unscientific, Democratic primary this week. And while nobody got the majority, there was a lot of people paying attention online.
Well, and in fact, 317,000 votes were cast. That's more than the New Hampshire Democratic primary and the Iowa caucuses put together.
Right. Yeah.
No delegates were chosen.
Right.
In fact, if you were to stand at any corner in Boston today and ask who won that thing, if you found someone, that person probably should be in an institution.
Although, of course, Howard Dean was very happy that he topped the list with 43%, but it's interesting that nobody was able to get 50%.
It's like the Iowa straw poll. Who won the Iowa straw poll in 1996?
I have no idea.
Right.
Exactly. Well, it's sort of only the people to whom it matters pay attention to these things.
Right.
Well, let's turn to some other topics in the news. The administration does seem to be having some success in the Middle East. Of course, Israelis and Palestinians over the weekend have agreed to a truce after 2 days of intensive negotiations by Condoleezza Rice. What do you think? Is this a truce that's going to last, particularly if the Bush administration really does put its full weight behind it?
Well, I think we'll have to wait and see. I mean, the Israelis are hedging their bets. You know, we've seen breakthroughs like this before. Just about a month ago, there was great hope after the summit in Jordan that, you know, this was a new beginning, and then immediately we saw the violence break out. So you could never say, never in the Middle East.
You know, Andrew makes a very smart point here, and it leads to the conclusion that any president who invests too much of his own political capital in an arena which is controlled by the Israelis and the Palestinians, is asking for trouble.
Well, and certainly Bill Clinton learned that to his dismay.
Right.
Let's talk for a moment about Medicare. As you know, last week, both chambers of Congress passed different versions of bills that would provide prescription drug coverage to seniors. That now all goes to conference committee, and the details will presumably be worked out there. But there are some real differences between these two versions, and none of the insurance companies have signed on to it yet. So what are your feelings about what kind of bill is going to emerge and whether it would be signed by the president and whether it would even work?
I view these things the way I view the NBA playoffs. I turn in around the third or fourth game when we're close to the end, and then you have a sense of what's really going to happen. It's too early right now to tell.
Yeah, and I'd like to just say that there are some very big differences, and this is this is the biggest overhaul since Medicare began 38 years ago. So there are a lot of details. And, you know, last week I was talking to senior citizens around the country, you know, getting their view of it. And you know, you'd think that they'd be thrilled, but they're not. They're worried. They, you know, they look at the costs, and, you know, some of them will save some money, but really not that much. And some of them won't save anything at all. And it's complicated. And several years ago, Congress tried to give a catastrophic health care insurance to the seniors, which sounded like a great idea. But then they realized how much it was going to cost. And, you know, we had pictures on TV of seniors, you know, harassing members of Congress, and they actually repealed it. So, you know, it's not a done deal.
And which side's going to claim credit for this, assuming that that anyone even wants to claim credit for it?
Oh, you know the answer to that. They both will. If people like it,
if it works,
blame each other.
Right.
Well, as always, thank you both so much, Andrea and David.
Thank you.
It was my pleasure.
Andrea Stone is congressional correspondent for USA Today. David Tribman is executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, online snooping. In an effort to track down terrorists, the federal government is trying to use every tool it can.
That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, we begin a week-long series on civil liberties with the case of an American imprisoned for more than a year without charges or legal representation.
I know of nothing like it in American history, and I'm familiar with many episodes of repression in times of war and stress. I think this is the farthest reach for unilateral executive power in American history, and very frightening.
And mashups, online mixing and matching of previously recorded hits.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Marianne Nichols. A bishop who ushered a Massachusetts diocese through one of the most explosive clergy sex abuse cases is expected to be named Archbishop of Boston. The independent newspaper, the National Catholic Reporter, says Bishop Sean Patrick O'Malley will likely be selected to lead the Boston Archdiocese. The Reverend Richard McBrien, professor of theology at Notre Dame, says O'Malley wasn't simply picked for his record on dealing with sex abuse by priests.
He is reliably conservative. He is utterly loyal to the Holy See. I mean, look, any bishop that was to be named to Boston or any other major see is going to come from a very limited pool. The overwhelming majority of bishops in the United States now are very conservative.
O'Malley would succeed Cardinal Bernard Law, who resigned in December amid the clergy sex abuse scandal. An NBC News employee has been injured in the Iraqi town of Fallujah. The TV network says Australian soundman Jeremy Little was hurt when a rocket-propelled grenade was fired at a Humvee equipped with a missile launcher. The AP's Steve Gutkin has been following the story.
What happened was insurgents fired a rocket-propelled grenade at a U.S. military vehicle, and Mr. Little evidently was embedded with the military at the time. His injuries are being described as not life-threatening. The U.S. military says that he is in stable condition.
The incident occurred on the second day of a massive sweep intended to capture Saddam loyalists and curb attacks on American soldiers. There's been more violence in the Middle East. The Israeli military says Palestinians opened fire on workers building a security fence near the town of Qalqilya. Three hours earlier, a militia linked to Fatah claimed responsibility for killing a Romanian truck driver on an Israeli construction crew. The attacks come just a day after Palestinian militant groups announced a suspension of attacks against Israelis. Presidential hopeful Senator John Kerry says the Boeing company needs help from the government to be able to compete with rival Airbus. The Massachusetts Democrat tells the Seattle Times he'd support a World Trade Association investigation into Airbus, which is accused of receiving unfair subsidies. He says the U.S. should cut taxes on Boeing and take other measures to support the company. On Wall Street at this hour, stocks are mixed. The Dow is up 4 points at 89.93.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris. Bill Delaney is away.
It's Here and Now.
On the 8th of May last year, an ex-convict from Chicago, an American citizen named Jose Padilla, was taken into federal custody for questioning. The Justice Department applied to have Padilla testify before a grand jury. After a week, the courts assigned him a lawyer. 3 weeks after that, without warning, President Bush declared that Jose Padilla was an enemy combatant. At a news conference in Moscow, Attorney General John Ashcroft alleged that Padilla was involved with al-Qaeda in planning to detonate a so-called dirty bomb. Padilla was transferred to a military prison in Charleston, South Carolina. More than a year later, he's still there. A federal judge has ruled that Padilla should be able to challenge his detention as an enemy combatant, but the government has appealed, and in the meantime, Padilla remains in solitary confinement. As part of a week-long series investigating the state of civil liberties in America, we're joined now by Andrew Patel, one of the lawyers representing Jose Padilla. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Let me start with you're representing Mr. Padilla with attorney Donna Newman. You sued the government for that right. Why was that even an issue? Isn't that something that we all have as American citizens?
Mr. Padilla's never been heard in court. In other words, his response to what the government has said about him has never been heard. And what Judge McKasey ultimately decided last December was that through counsel, he has the right to be heard.
And yet the government is appealing.
That is correct. Their argument is that Mr. Padilla has not been charged with a crime. The Sixth Amendment right to counsel only applies to people who have been charged with a crime. So they say, well, he doesn't have a right to counsel under the Sixth Amendment. They're saying they're just holding him for questioning. And one must wonder where in a democracy the government believes it has the authority to hold the citizen indefinitely and without access to a court, without access to counsel, to question them.
Have you even been able to meet with your client since he was declared officially as an enemy combatant?
We have not been able to meet with him. We have been able to write to him, but we have absolutely no assurances that anything we send to him has been received, and we have good reason to believe that it has not.
Are you concerned about the conditions under which he's being held?
Absolutely. You know, the effects of prolonged sensory deprivation are well documented. Now, what the government has said is that they want to hold him until he has provided whatever information he has, voluntarily or involuntarily, so one must be concerned about his well-being.
Well, Andrew, we thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Andrew Patel is the lawyer for Jose Padilla, an American who has been declared an enemy combatant. For more on this case, we turn now to Anthony Lewis, an author and former New York Times columnist who has a longstanding interest in constitutional law and issues. Welcome.
I'm glad to be here.
What about this case, Anthony? Because the judge first agreed with the Bush administration that the president does have the authority to detain unlawful combatants. Can we say then this was a victory for the government?
I thought it was a very large victory for the government, but the judge went on to say that he thought Mr. Padilla should be allowed to discuss with his counsel at least a very limited discussion, but limited to what he could say that would throw light on the reasons the government gave for designating him as an enemy combatant. In other words, suppose the reason said he had a meeting with Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan on such and such a date, and he could say, well, I wasn't in Afghanistan. In other words, things that would directly respond to the reasons for the designation.
Do you find this chilling or understandable?
Oh, I find it extremely chilling. I know of nothing like it in American history, and I'm familiar with many episodes of repression in times of war and stress. I think this is the farthest reach for unilateral executive power in American history, and very frightening. I want to say something. This isn't just some sort of lackadaisical liberal view. There's a piece in the Financial Times last week by Edward Crane and William Niskanen of the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian organization in Washington, that is right-wing but libertarian, which, among other things, deplores what it calls, I'll read what it says, under no circumstances should an American be held captive indefinitely with no charges filed and no legal representation afforded.
That's certainly something that most of us think we have the right to.
Well, I thought the Constitution said that, but I guess I'm only reading the words.
Give us a little history here. Where does the right to habeas corpus come from?
Well, the Constitution explicitly recognizes the right of habeas corpus, the right to go into court and demand that any government that has you in prison justify that imprisonment. That's what habeas corpus means. And it says that habeas corpus shall not be suspended except in time of war, and it suggests that's by act of Congress. But the basic right here is the right in the Fifth Amendment, which says that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, and to be held indefinitely, maybe for the rest of your life, with no charges, no trial, and no lawyer, doesn't sound to me like due process of law.
Is there any justification for it in your mind in this post-September 11th world that, you know, these are extraordinary times and Congress has now authorized the president to use, quote, all necessary and appropriate force to counter and prevent terrorism?
Yes. The government's claim And of course, it is a kind of justification. It's a claim justification, is that you have to be able to take suspects, keep them isolated, and bring to bear all the psychological tricks and pressures that might make people talk about any connections they have with terrorism. I, by the way, I'm not making up that justification, because it's explicitly stated in an affidavit the government produced in the Padilla case, saying that in order to get information from such a person, you have to keep him isolated and not have any contact with the outside world for perhaps indefinitely. The affidavit says there have been cases where it's gone on for years before we got useful information.
The government's position here seems to be, listen, if you are a law-abiding American citizen and not a potential terrorist, you have nothing to worry about. We're not going to be dragging you off the street and throwing you into jail. Is that a good enough reassurance?
Well, it's at odds with the whole history of American justice and the American Constitution, because what's implicit in what you've just said is that the government is to define who has to do with terrorism. You may think you have nothing to do with terrorism, but if George W. Bush says you do, then under this government theory, you do. You just sit there in that cell, seeing nobody except your interrogators for, you know, Padilla's been inside now for a little over a year, and there's no knowing how long he'll be in there.
Anthony Lewis, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Anthony Lewis is an author and commentator with a long-standing interest in constitutional law.
Tomorrow, we continue our series on civil liberties in America with a look at how the federal government is using the Internet in its search for terrorists.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Hundreds of thousands of people marched in New York City this weekend in the 34th annual Gay Pride Parade. They were celebrating what they called a month of victories. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down laws banning sodomy. And earlier this month, Canada became the third country to allow gay couples to marry. Well, producer Karen Pellin joined the throngs in New York to find out if this Pride Day felt any different.
Certainly. With the Supreme Court? Absolutely. You know, I remember 17 years ago, but just, this is incredible. I almost screamed at my desk when I found out. I mean, it's phenomenal. I mean, it has to be done, and it's great. The timing of that couldn't be better.
I haven't been to a parade in a while. It's very big, very different. I'm happy that the case went the way it did. I'm surprised and very excited the Supreme Court was 6-3.
Well, I think gay marriages should be legal. And it seems a nonsense, especially in a country that keeps saying it's got all faiths included, that the stumbling block should somehow be the church or the synagogue or whatever, that it just seems a nonsense. That so many people, especially in a city like New York, will openly chase after a Wall Street lawyer who earns $200,000, $300,000 a year simply for his money. And the day he resigns from that and becomes a gardener, they'll divorce him. So why is that so different than having whatever reason you want to get married?
Well, I think in the past was always a plea for equality. This year, in this week alone, we've had major legislation in the country. My own state, Delaware, just had House Bill 99 pass.
What's House Bill 99 in Delaware?
Equal protection, non-discrimination in housing and employment for gays and lesbians, sexual orientation.
Did you travel up here for the parade?
Yes, we did, from Delaware. This morning, we're on a bus waiting for our group from AIDS Delaware, the youth group. We're going to be joining them.
Are you going to be marching?
Yes.
Oh, excellent. You're from Texas?
From Texas.
How did you feel about the decision?
I had no...
You didn't know?
No, I knew about it, but I mean, that's their decision they made, and that's people's choices they make, so I don't have an opinion on it.
And why did you come out to Pride today?
Because we're in New York, and we're visiting here as tourists, and we saw the parade, we came down to it. It's interesting.
Yeah?
It's very interesting.
What do you think?
I think it's interesting. I'm trying to be open-minded about everything. I mean, you never know how things turn out in life, so they deserve a fair shake, I guess, just like everybody else, you know?
We already had this trip planned and didn't realize that this was going to be a part of it until Thursday night, but we were bringing 14 children up, and we have those kids here with us. today.
From where?
North Carolina. They came up to participate in some dance classes, and this was part of what we wanted to show them, that there is a lot of other things and other lifestyles out there, and they do have the right to choose what they want to choose.
You guys came up from North Carolina?
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
And what do you think about this parade?
I love it.
This is awesome.
It's awesome.
I think it's so cool.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen anything like this in North Carolina?
No.
How old are you?
13.
You ever seen shorts that short on a guy?
No, not usually.
Oh, wait till Mom hears. Our visit to New York City's 34th annual Gay Pride Parade was produced by Karen Pelland.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
There is a lot of electronic music out there. Some good, some bad, much of it without even an ounce of humanity. But now there's a new web trend called mashups. Mashups take the unrelenting mechanical beats of electronic dance music and mix them with the human voices of some of today's and yesterday's superstars. Joni Mitchell with a barely recognizable Big Yellow Taxi. And Here and Now's Rock and Pop critic is in the studio to tell us more about this song and this new craze. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Robin.
So who's messing with my Joni Mitchell?
Well, that is actually Mitchell herself, who did a remix of her own song and put it out just below the radar about 10 years ago on the soundtrack to a new hit TV sitcom called Friends.
10 years ago?
10 years ago. And if you track this Friends soundtrack down, it is credited to Joni Mitchell, and she went in the studio and remixed a new backing track to her very famous Big Yellow Taxi song.
Did people know this at the time? Where was I?
It was put out, but it was, you know, it was one of those soundtracks, and
yeah.
It did okay, and it had other big songs on it, and, you know, it just sort of went under the radar. Nobody seemed to notice it. So that's where the vocal to one track was placed on top of a completely new rhythm track that she herself came up with. And, of course, composers have been doing this for a long time. They'll set lyrics. You'll have a melody that will get transposed and put into a string quartet that might have first been a song. So this idea of setting new underground, a new bedding to a top of a song, to the singer of a song, is actually a very old idea.
It's but sampling, too. I mean...
Well, it's sampling, too, which we've heard a lot in rap in the past 20 years. Grab a snatch of this song, you know, what you think is the hippest part of this song, and put it into your groove and spice up the groove with something that's recognizable. And there was another famous example of this a couple of years ago in the soundtrack to Ocean's 11,
mm-hmm.
where a mix master named JX had Elvis Presley surfing above a newfangled groove with a song called A Little Less Conversation.
A little less conversation, a little more action.
this aggravation, a satisfaction in me. A little more fine, a little less fun. A little less fine, a little more spark. Throw your mouth and open up your heart, and maybe satisfy me. Satisfy me, baby.
We talked about this at the time when it became number one in Britain.
Right.
You know, Elvis hit the top of the charts. So what did he do there? Did he somehow find this voice? Or can you strip away the instruments underneath the voice?
This is the latest advancement in musical technology on computers, is that now these software jocks are able to strip away the backings and isolate the vocal of one track, and then do the opposite with another track, strip away the vocal of one track and retain just the backing track. Right, so that you create sort of a karaoke situation where you could sing on top of it. But then the really big imaginative leap, that it's actually as much of a technical leap as it is an imaginative leap, is that they graph these two things together. Mm-hmm. And you find a vocal track that will fit or fit close enough with a different rhythm track from a different song. So what you're composing really is two completely different tracks, and you're putting them together. So you have to imagine this might fit in with that other track, and with the software I'm using, I can slow it down or speed it up just enough to make sure it fits with these new beats. Mm-hmm. The best example of this new thing, which is called a mashup, again, which is not composing a new element to an existing thing. It's taking two pre-existing elements and putting them together in an imaginative way. The most notorious example came out last year with a song called A Stroke of Genius, and it combined a vocal track by Christina Aguilera from a song she sang called Genie in a Bottle, and put it on top of a big hit for the Strokes. So let's listen to Christina Aguilera's original first, and then we'll segue into the new mashup that was created.
Okay.
I feel like I've been locked up tight for a century of lonely nights, waiting for someone to release me.
Christina Aguilera, to my ear, performs a lot of this bland, electronic, soulless material, but you can't deny that she's a really terrific singer.
Tim Riley is his name. Are you Christina Aguilera fans? Yeah.
Well, but what you do is you isolate the vocal. You say, I don't want to deal with the whole Christina Aguilera record. I'll just take her vocal and put whatever backing I want to it. This is what these mixmasters are doing now.
Some of the legal issues here?
Well, it's got all kinds of legal issues circling around. And of course, both the Strokes and Christina Aguilera issued cease and desist orders for any radio stations that tried to play that, and they tried to prevent people from downloading it, which is the opposite reaction that you would expect from someone who comes out with like a really great recreation of some of your work. Mm-hmm. There was a...
And they don't benefit. They don't make any money from it, I would assume.
No, they don't make any money from it. But that's the thing, is that these people aren't trying to make money. These people are going to produce a hit in a mashup very soon where they can't help but make money, because the record labels are going to have to put it out to meet demand, because mm-hmm. the demand for this track was really very high. It made some critics' top 10 lists last year.
There's so many questions. And yet you could, when you say they put this out, they've only put it out on some website.
On the web, right. And so there are these cults developing around these different mixmasters. I found another website called DSICO.com, which is just reverses the letters of the word disco to make it psycho. Mm-hmm. And he came up with a different reinterpretation of the same Christina Aguilera song. So we're going to hear Christina Aguilera again. This time she's singing on top of Sonic Youth.
I feel like I've been locked up tight for a century of lonely nights. With someone to miss me.
Boy, if I were Christina Aguilera, I'd fire my band and hire one of these and get a new producer, too.
Absolutely you would.
Because the sound is just great.
Well, and it's so much more imaginative than the prepackaged, pre-formatted stuff that they have her singing. I mean, it's so much more imaginative. I mean, this is really the great thing about mashups, is you can't get over how imaginative it is. And then you realize, when you start working with this software, I tried to do a couple of these myself. It's very tricky because you have to slow down some of the elements in order to make them fit together. You have to make sure they're in similar enough keys that it will work. one of the cool things about that Joni Mitchell thing we heard earlier on is that she creates her bottom in a completely different key than the vocal. And it works, mm-hmm. right? So you have to be very sophisticated musically, just in a kind of intuitive sense. Like, this might just fit with this. When I was reading about this, they'd say, yeah, it's really hit or miss. Sometimes it really works great, and other times it's just not quite effective.
Well, but when it's great, it is great. And you were saying that someday that might force record companies, who are in danger of extinction now anyway, to make deals with these mashup guys.
We're going to have to, because they're the most creative force in the music industry today.
But in the meantime, they don't have those record deals, so what's in it for them?
Well,
it's so much work.
You know, just the sheer thrill of hitting on something like Stroke of Genius, because, I mean, that is just like an underground sensation. Yeah. That just shows what you can do with this technology, and it's just the beginning. Yeah. I mean, wait till we get to the Jimi Hendrix of mashups, you know. They're going to show us all these wild, incredible things you can do, how you can bend these pre-existing tracks into new and interesting things. The record labels and the lawyers, they're all going to have to catch up with these people.
Right. Well, lot to think about. What should we listen to as we do?
Well, let's go out with another mashup I found that uses several different Prince tracks. This is a track called Beastie Prince, which uses elements both from Beastie Boys and several well-known Prince tracks.
Sounds like the Chipmunks joined them as well. Well, thanks so much, Tim, as usual.
Thank you, Robin.
Here are now pop and rock critic Tim Riley, also author of Tell Me Why, the Beatles album by album, song by song, the 60s and after, which has just been reissued in paperback. For more on mashups, go to our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink, Tech.